Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to the A24 Project here on the Nerd Party Network. Every 2 weeks, we look at two films from the A24 filmography, and in between, we try and interview the talent involved, from people like Bo Burnham to Millie Shapiro. In this interview episode, I'm joined by actor Krisha Fairchild to discuss her titular role in Trey Edward Schultz, Krisha. For those who haven't got around to seeing the film yet, it sees Krisha, who returns for Thanksgiving dinner after 10 years away from her family, but her past demons threaten to ruin the festivities. Krisha takes me behind the scenes on the film, where she was directed by her nephew and starred alongside family members to tell an incredibly personal story. This is one of my favourite interviews to record. Thanks to Krisha for being so generous with her time. Hope you'll enjoy this interview, and me and Dallas will be back again next week.
The best place to start is, I just wanted to say congratulations on being immortalised as a mug this week. How does that feel?
You know, being a mug is like a big thing when it's an A24 mug. So I'm very, very... I feel very blessed, and of course they're sending me one for free, which is the best.
That's exactly how I noticed you the other day. Like, I'd seen the film a few months ago, we touched on it on the show, and then I kind of saw the mugs, and I was like, oh yeah, I'll have Wee Nosey at the replies, sort of killing some time at the weekend. And then I noticed you'd replied, and I was like, I'd really like to reach out to you because you've got this unique film within their filmography. From interviews I've read about the film and yourself, you sound like such an interesting character. So I'm glad that you're getting a mug and sort of that your tweet has managed to sort of bring us together today.
I agree. See, all good things happen for a reason. And it actually was a joke because I had just been with the girl who runs that department in Telluride. I just met her, and she mentioned something about that. You know, she was doing that, and I kind of forget sometimes that there are a lot of people who are reading what I say and not knowing that I'm just like this prankster person. So it was a big joke, and then when she jumped in with the whole, "Of course, we're sending it to you," I immediately wrote her and went, "No, I didn't mean that." And then I went, "Well, wait a minute, though."
Well, if you could put in a nice word for them and see if they can send us some free candles, that would be much appreciated.
Candles? Are you doing like hereditary type rituals or?
Well, I've always been curious. Like, they've been selling these candles. They're like $40, and it's like you get a sci-fi candle, a horror candle, and I would love to know what a sci-fi candle smells like. But for $45, that's a big gamble to take for me.
For me, if it's that much money, it should melt down to a little action figure, shouldn't it?
Absolutely. And come with a free Hereditary Blu-ray and its own little sort of portable head as well.
Indeed. You know, I actually have a Blu-ray of Krisha, and I'm actually thinking of opening a new eBay account without my name attached and trying to, you know, see how much money I could get for it.
There you go. Just sign a few copies and stuff. It's an easy way to make a living.
Indeed. No, I never fall that low.
I always kind of like to start these things with finding out how kind of people found the inspiration to turn something like this into a career. That you've been an actress for decades now, and I'd love to know what made you kind of take that leap into the acting world, and what inspired you to do it.
Well, I was one of those kids who they called a ham. And what that meant to me, I was an introvert, and I felt that when I was with people who did not know me or might not accept the inner me, I had an outer me that was very big and very showy and very flashy. So my happiest times, I was in the woods with my dog. But when there were other people around, I was doing Elvis Presley impersonations when I was like six. So I think it seemed to everyone like a natural fit. The reality was I loved reading, and so I made up characters in my head, but also I saw every character in every book in my head. And then it just seemed as though I got some support from it in school, and I won awards and stuff. And when it was time to go to college, I actually scored a big scholarship, and I thought, this is strange. People are going to like put me through school to act, and yet my parents insisted that I would end up with a teaching degree because they, you know, parents never really believe that you're going to make it in any creative endeavor, which is actually, interestingly enough, a sidebar for later, a part of how I became kind of an important aunt in Trey's life is because I was the one who just pushed against everybody else and said, no, 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 no. If he believes this, then we need to give him this chance. So anyway, did college, got in the unions, was a professional actor. Everybody kept telling me, you know, you need to get off the stage and go do movies. I felt it wasn't my place. I was very large in everything I did, and I didn't think I could act for film, but I moved to LA and I hated it. It was every corrupt thing that I had ever heard about it was absolutely true. And I got, you know, I got casting call propositions. One, I mean, imagine this. So a young actress who's classically trained, like say I went to RADA or somewhere like that, because I ended up at the Goodman Theater School in Chicago, which was one of the professional theater schools of the ilk of Yale or one of those. And I got a big audition in LA, and I go onto this studio lot, and I'm all dressed up, and a man I've been watching my whole life in TV and movies calls me into his office to read for something, and that's not what he wanted from me. And I was shocked. I couldn't believe that. I thought those stories had been made up. So I quickly stopped trying to pursue my art, and I became a personal assistant. I worked for celebrities and people in the field. I worked for the Sinatra family for a while, which people think I made up, but my name is in her book thanking me for having helped her. So, and working from that side of it, I really lost my belief in the actor's part in the creative process, working from the office. I mean, I was the one who threw away the headshots that people sent in. So I stopped. I stopped trying to pursue it, and I moved away. I moved to Seattle. And in Seattle, I stumbled into voice acting, which was my salvation, because I have a beautiful voice. I can do narration, I can do commercials, I can do anything, and I could do it from a booth in my closet in a bikini if I wanted to. And that's those middle decades when I was still a professional actress and was, you know, earning all my keep that way through union work. It was a completely anonymous form of it, which I loved, because the introvert could go acting with me in that way. So, all right, now you just got to jump forward to that. I was in Hawaii and I was in my 50s. And I, okay, in the Crecia story, for people who've seen it, there's a relative who raises someone else's child. And that was actually me. I had a great nephew whose mother was an addict, the character that my character in Crecia is based on. And when he was 10, she fell off the, she didn't just fall off the wagon, she kind of fell off the whole globe. And I took him in. And while I was raising him, Trey, who was just a teenager that this young boy adored his whole life, Trey started spending his summers in Hawaii, kind of to be a, you know, be a mensch, to be a male figure in this kid's life that he hadn't had, and to hang out, and because Trey loves the ocean, and he and I had always been close. And so during that, it was like a rebonding. We had always bonded when he was a kid, but during that rebonding is when he was very first starting to think maybe could actually be a director, because he'd wanted to be all his whole life. And he ended up writing a couple shorts, and he, you know, he knew I used to be an actor and still was supporting myself, not in any visible way. And he asked me to do these shorts, and you will never see them because they're locked away now, because they were, you know, had he been in film school, they would have been like film school shorts. And Robin and I were in both of them. His mother, Robin, who's in Crecia, who plays my sister, we carried both of them. And okay, so here's the thing to know. This is a kid who's, I think he was maybe 20 when we started this. Both of the shorts were about grief. So that's a pretty interesting statement about his arc. And they both had some really interesting stuff in it. But they didn't work completely, but they were him learning. And after that, he cloistered himself and watched all the movies in the world. And he asked me, you know, who are your favorite directors? And then he would watch a director from start to finish, from first film to the most contemporary one. He'd watch them repeatedly, and that's how he schooled himself. And then how I got back into the loop is that when the boy I was raising, when his mother did die of an overdose, Trey wrote Krisha and asked me if I thought I could play it. And what's ironic is I'm a teetotaler. I'm the one when I was young. If everybody was dropping like a tab of acid, I was taking like a little nibble off the edge because I, the introvert again, you know, I had to be in control of my mind and my instrument. And so playing that was an interesting stretch for me, but he trusted me. And that's how I ended up back into this crazy business, but in a different kind of way than I would have been had I gotten into it when I was young.
Definitely. That's a hell of a career that you've just spanned in the space of sort of 5-10 minutes. I'm curious, when you talk about your voice work, and is there anything that you sometimes find people go, you're maybe talking to them, whether it's getting oil or chatting to them at a party, and someone goes, do I recognize your voice from something? What's the one that always stands out for people?
It happens all the time, but they don't know what from. They might be recognizing my voice. But I will tell you, this is my very favorite story. For many years, I was the voice on heart defibrillator machines, right? So the things that people grab in airports or shopping malls or whatever off the wall and drag over and try to save someone's life when they're having a heart attack in front of you and there is no doctor there. So I'm the voice in many epochs of those machines that is telling you how to stay calm. And these are the things that you need to do. And let's just stay very calm while we do this. And I always thought, what if someday it's me? And I'm laying there and someone brings the machine and I save my own life.
That's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the way my mind works. I'm very cosmic and... So yeah, it happens all the time, but they don't know what it's from.
So like, obviously you've had this incredible career in voice work and film, and then something like Krisha comes along. You touched on it sort of, it was drawn really from a family experience, this family member who had kind of passed away and had this overdose. Was it a cathartic experience to get involved in a project like this, or was there a hesitation of almost stepping in perhaps into an open wound perhaps?
I think it speaks very well for my family in that there was zero hesitation on any of our parts, partly because Trey really wanted grandmother, our mother, the woman in the wheelchair, Gigi. He really wanted her to be alive, to be in it, because she was, the epitome of a good mother and a good grandmother to all of us. And then her drinking, which had been secret for most of her life, started causing her to have strokes and falling down and all these things that it does. And it was sad for all of us, so sad. But he wanted to find an opportunity to have her on camera and see if we could bring her back to us in that way. And when he stated it that way, we were nervous about the story because... we lived through it, and it was still fresh when he wrote it, which is very often the case when people write amazing things. But we didn't hesitate for a moment, none of us. Our Nika, the niece that was the one who died, her mother is Vicky, the woman with the really curly red and silver hair who pushes the wheelchair in, and it was hardest for her. But we stayed there. It was cathartic, and it was, I know this sounds crazy, the magic of what happened in the 9 days that we took making that movie is not something you can create. The universe created it for us to have that healing experience that would also happen to be a breakthrough for Trey and kind of put him on his path for life. And interestingly enough, I never expected, put me on a path for life that I'm really grateful to have gotten to walk, because I don't know if you have friends from childhood that are in any of the arts, but there's some of the arts that you get to practice alone and you get the same juju from them inside. You get the same feeling inside, like a painter who's painting in their workshop. It's got to feel really good while they're painting. A singer who's practicing singing. But for an actor, if you're practicing acting alone, you may be locked up. And and we have to have someone hire us and an audience before we get to practice our craft. So for Trey, it's the same with a director. You can direct in your room. That's great. But you have to have the money to put something in front of people. And the fact that we got to do that, and it changed his life, and it changed my life. And it also helped change Nika's kids' lives, because they'd lived a pretty hard road. She was an alcoholic and a drug addict. And they'd been in her life and out of her life, and finally we just had to take all three of them out of her life. But when they saw the film, and I was privileged to be able to sit with them when they saw it for the first time in a festival. And when they saw that, they saw a side of their mother that they had missed during all the while. So yeah, cathartic and exceptionally valuable to all of us.
Sounds like a really unique family photo album in a way. We're so used to pulling something off the shelves and looking through. This sounds like a very modern way to just be able to put something on the TV or to watch on a computer and to kind of see a family brought to life in such a unique way.
I agree with you. I think that it was very fascinating for people that the real family was doing it. And yet, I bet you if there are nascent film directors and screenwriters and whatnot out there, I bet you their families would do that for them if they needed them to, because who doesn't want the child in your family to get the chance to speak their truth, you know?
Absolutely. How much kind of responsibility were you given for helping to craft this character? I mean, ultimately they share your name, and was there any ever sort of worries about this character with their behavior, their addictions, sharing that same name with you, or was it always going to be a Krisha?
No, the name was an accident. The way the character was shared in her creation is just that Trey knows me and he knows I'm a research nut. And so when he told me he was writing it, I just started doing research about what we knew of the medications, for instance, that Nika was on, and how they would have combined with alcohol. And she was bipolar and also an addict. So I just flooded him with links to articles about bipolar and about medication and interactions of medications. And then I sent him photographs that I had loved of because the character is really an amalgam of my mom and Nika. And we talked a little bit about mannerisms, and we talked a little bit about some of the classic alcoholic behaviors, the blaming and the victimhood and those things. And he already had it framed. And then when I began to bring things like that, I think then he fine-tuned some things. And then the thing that you have to remember here, and again, this is a good message for young filmmakers, the feature Krisha that you saw was our second attempt at it. We all got together 2 years before we made the feature Krisha, thinking we were making the feature. It was just the family. He had no money. He had no way to bring in other professional actors. He had the bare bones camera kit. He had it had to be all shot available light. There was not a light kit. There wasn't any of the things that there was one audio guy. There was one camera guy that he had no steady cam. He had no dollies. He had no. And about halfway through it, and he tells this story on himself, so I feel okay about telling it. We woke up one morning to complete a scene in the kitchen. You have to use available light. He knew the house. He knew where the light was at certain times of day. We had shot the front half of this scene the day before at X time. The next day we wake up, and at X time it is pouring rain outside. And the light in no way will ever batch. And Trey just kind of walked away, and everybody's kind of like, what's going on? And his mother and his stepdad and I found him in the master bedroom having a breakdown. He was in bed, fetal, and sobbing. And he said, I was so stupid to try to do this. I'm not ready. I don't have what I need. And, you know, all that fear junk that just pours out of people when they feel that. I'm about to fail. And because we were three people who've known him and helped him through things like this when he was six, we just listened. And then we said, his stepdad, I remember, said, okay, so you can't make a feature. What could you make? Could you make a short? And you could see him kind of start thinking. And he went, well, I probably can make enough to make a short. And I said, so let's do that. Let's just, we don't care. We're just here for you. And he's like, but Keita, which is my family nickname, Keita, you, I'm so disappointed. And I'm like, that bullshit. You know, let's get back out there and regroup. And we'll just make some lemonade out of these lemons, okay? And we were like cheerleaders. We get him up. He goes back out. Nobody knows what's going on. They just know that, you know, he's maybe had an allergy attack or something because his eyes are red. And they regroup, and we get back to work, and we shot the whole 11 days. And he sat with the footage for 2 years and trimming away and shaping. And he turned it into the short, Krisha, which is the one that first was seen at South by Southwest in 2014. Think? No, 2013. Oh, I'm too old to remember years. You can look it up. And that short is the one that allowed him to raise the money for the feature, which he did. South by was in March. He raised enough money to make the feature, and we shot August 1st. We started shooting. So for us, it was a redo. It was a do-over. When do you ever get that? Well, the reality is, a friend of mine in Guy Nativ, who made a short.
I've interviewed him recently, actually. Yeah, he's going to be up on the show in a couple of weeks' time, actually. Brilliant guy.
A brilliant guy. And you know his story. Then you know that. He was, you know, at early days, he was talking to me about a role in Skin, and then the story went a different direction. But he said, you know, I'm not getting it. It's not coming together. And then he came to me one day and he went, I'm going to make a short. And I'm like, yeah. There you go. He made the short of Skin. He parlayed it into the feature of Skin. It's a perfectly respectable, acceptable way now to work in this business, as it should be. Because what first-time director needs to have millions of dollars riding on their back? Zero is that. That's the number of them that need that. They need to be able to make something that's within their reach and within their means. And then that can show people what they can do. So Krisha is the classic example of that. When we finally came together to make that feature, when he had all the money, by that time, all the research, all that stuff had been done. He had tweaked the script with all the things that we had found. He and I talked about things in the character that we wanted to change from the short to this one, things we felt missing, things that would make her richer or deeper. I'm saying to him, remember how Nika carried all of her medications around in a locked box? I said, I bought a locked box, and I'm going to wear a key around my neck, and I'm going to wear the key on a chain that used to belong to my mom. And he's crazy for stuff like that. He says to me, I'm going to put up all the family pictures all over, all up and down the hallway. I've taken all the art off the walls in the house, and I've put them all. And I've set up all the shots. This is like 2 months before we're going to shoot, right? And he's like, and in the bathroom where you're going to be doing all your hard stuff, I've got like books about darkness and about psychology. And so he said, so you'll be able to sit in there between takes and like read these books. And from start to finish, I showed up with a blanket that I wanted to be her blanket and pillows that were her blanket, her pillows. And the dog was my mother's dog. The little dog. And it just was from the get-go when we had the chance to do it over. We didn't think about the filmmaking. Well, he certainly did. The actors did not have to think about the filmmaking for a single moment. All we had to do was live in this world that he had created. And I mean, he transformed the set. He did it. We did it all ourselves. That's the other thing that I think is so funny. We all the actors did their own hair, makeup, and wardrobe. We didn't have money for that. You know, it was like the actors were in the dining room ironing their costumes for the next. When Mom was there, she had to be kind of sat with in a room off to the side, and the actors took turns going and visiting with her as their characters, as her grandchildren, as her son-in-law. It was, it just became magical because it was meant to be, and we all felt that. We all felt it. Every moment we were on set, we all felt that something very special was being made there. And listen, I'm as humble as you like about other things, but that film, I will never really be able to pull off humility, because it was an amazing thing that he did and we did with and for him.
Absolutely. That's an incredible story. Thank you so much for sharing it. And one thing that always had me curious, when I'd obviously a family making a film together, isn't anything particularly new. It's been kind of common in the past. And, you know, Krish, I think, is a really great modern example of it. What I was wondering was, is it difficult to disconnect from thinking of those opposite you in a scene as family members? So, you know, we all think of, you know, some of the scenes are so intense, you know, really challenging, you know, a lot of toxic behavior. It's an intense film to watch. I was wondering, what's it like in those scenes when you film it and then you think, right, how do you disconnect from what you've just done, but the people opposite you are still your family members? What's that dynamic like?
Well, good question, because what it is like is therapy. It's like family counseling, because before the camera rolls and after the camera stops rolling, there has to be a real connection that is made, and then you step away and you go into where you need to be and you do what you need to do, and when the camera stops and the scene is done and it's in the can, people rush together. And Robin's husband left the house and went to visit with his mother for the time we were filming so that I could share the master bedroom with her. We took baths together. We gave each other rubs. We nurtured each other. We held each other. We cried together, all of us. Vicky, after every scene that was a hard one, someone had Vicky in their arms. I know to a lot of people that'll sound creepy, but the reality is that if you're going to really go there with somebody that you love, and there is an iota of truth anywhere in what it is that you have to do, and you're having to take that iota and ramp it up through the ceiling and say vile, vicious things to that person, you better be ready to come back into their arms, because they have to understand that that is not where you're living and that is not where your mind is. And for Robin and I, we've loved each other our whole lives. We consider each other soulmates. And I had to find, in order to get angry at her, I had to go all the way back to something in my childhood, sometime when she like stole my candy or something. I mean, I literally could not find anything in my current history that would allow me to scream in her face. But I finally found something from childhood. And before I had to play that scene, I left the dining room and I went upstairs into Detre's bedroom where his three cats were waiting in terror because they knew I was about to come into the room and do this prep. And they watched me back and forth. And I had a glass, because I don't drink, I had a glass with scotch in it, and I would tap the scotch on my lips so that the taste of the scotch was there and I could remember that she was drunk. And I'm singing along to the speakers cranked up on Bob Dylan, Like a Rolling Stone, which is a song of disenfranchisement. You know, it's like, you all treated me like hell, and now I had to go out of anything I could think of and go into a song in order to scream at those people. And so that's what I did. And I paced back and forth and sang it to myself until I was in a real head of self-pity and just this totally dysfunctional place. And then I would call out to the guy outside the door, okay. He would go down and start the scene. And I would come barreling into the scene. You can't find that kind of rage for people that you love that much unless you really, really dig deep. And then after you've dug there, you better come back to the table and hold on to them. These actors that stay in character for the whole film could never do that. Too much karmic weight to that. You, while the camera's rolling and you're there, yes, absolutely, but you got to shake that shit off. You know, that's my feeling. I shake it off. I go back to being myself. So again, when we look at the introvert extrovert, when I go to the deep dark places, it's my introvert, but a very twisted one, not a version I ever embraced. And then when I come out of it, I'm a hostess again. I'm a love machine. I'm gonna make everything okay for everybody. I'm a codependent person. You know, I'm like the one running around and helping everybody. After one of the takes, a dish jumped up and cut my ankle. I'm bleeding and I'm walking around making sure that everybody else is okay. And finally somebody's, you're bleeding. I'm like, oh yes. The other thing that I think I have to mention is our mother was in that scene and she's demential. We needed her to know that we were playing. So after every take, Robin, Vicky, and I ran to Mom's side and held her in our arms and laughed and kissed all over each other. And we were like, Mom, look, we're playing. We were just playing. We were just pretending. We're just pretending. And yet, to me, one of the most heartbreaking moments in the film was a real moment when we had apparently nailed a scene so well that when I left the room, my mother says, Grisha, come back. Come back. And she forgot we were playing and she thought that we were angry at each other and she wanted to fix it. That one was really hard to do again because we were afraid we were going to take her there. So we were making faces into her face, you know, sticking out your tongue, googly eyes, fingers like children, right up until the moment when he yelled action and we both just spun away from her and went into it. And we had to think about that because when someone is demential, they don't understand the line between real and fantasy. And this was too close to some of the stuff she'd lived through. So, what you see is what we lived. What you see is what we had. My parents had fights where I can remember seeing the mustard running down the wall from a jar hitting the wall. I was six when I remember this. You know, we were a very loving family that happened to have three rageaholics in it. And you can love all you want, and there's going to be stuff from that. Trey's got a lot of stuff. His dad was an alcoholic and an addict. His mother was the most loving, embracing person in the world. But you can't change the fact that he witnessed stuff as a child that nobody should ever have to, but most kids do.
How do you look after yourself when you've got a role like this, where you are, you know, it sounds like an intense environment, you know, on a personal level and professionally as well. You know, you're this black sheep character in the film. It's the subject of, you know, quite vicious things, and you're giving it back too. How do you look after yourself at the end of a day where you go, I need to make sure that I feel okay for the next day? And, you know, while sitting with all this stuff that you're talking about as well, that's kind of being brought to the surface through, you know, these interactions with these characters and family members.
Well, good question. It starts before, long before you show up on the set. You have to know how to protect yourself in advance. So you ask for what you need in advance. For me, with the beginning of Grisha, I needed my own room. And then when we got a little bit into the movie and the filming, when Robin and I had to do the hard stuff together, I needed to be with her. And so that's what I asked for. Everyone was sleeping all over the floor and the couches. We all slept in the house. Maybe, I think four of the actors had a condo they stayed in, and the rest of us were sleeping in situ. And I said, and I need a bathroom. And I need the bathroom that Krisha's using. And that was a bathroom that would have been more convenient for about six people to use. So when you know yourself well, you know what you need. I knew I needed peace and quiet during the hours that I had to myself. And I knew that I needed a bathtub for soaking. And I knew that I needed, when I went outside into the yard and pulled my chair away, people had to understand that I was not accessible to them. I definitely protect myself. And you ask for it in advance. I'm a vegan now. I say, I'm going to need to be able to eat clean when I'm on the set, because I've had issues in my life with eating. And when I'm emotionally upset, I eat. Well, that's the last thing in the world you could do. When you're acting, you have to be 5,000% every day. You know, it was funny to me, because as I went further in the character, I started to look more and more like I was drunk. And that was because I know myself well enough that every night before bed, I would eat a piece of candy. And that sugar, that little bit of sugar, would make my eyes be swollen like an alcoholic in the morning. And so every artist gets to know, and certainly I was in my 60s when I played this, so I certainly knew that. You have to do those things for yourself, whether it's a massage or a bath going into a room and closing a door and screaming. Whatever it's going to be, you have to ask for it up front. I've never been able to understand the actors who go out drinking after a day of filming and come back the next day and they're completely 100%. I could never do that. I can't party. The only party I ever get to go to is the one after the day. Okay, I'll tell a good story about myself. I was just shooting a feature up in Garberville that's going to be in this winter season. We're going to be going into festivals. And I'm playing a pot grower, an old hippie woman. It's called Freeland, and it's the San Francisco Film Society's hooked up with it. And a couple documentary filmmakers who had this great story wanted to make a very small movie. So we're up there, and we're, you know, it's legal. Any kind of dope that you want is legal. And the first night after we'd all been together, the next day we were just doing locations and stuff. I didn't have any lines. I didn't have any responsibilities. When I was young, my God, I was like a big doper, you know? So we're sitting around and something's coming around at me, and I'm thinking, what the hell? You know, I take like a toke and I pass it around. And by the time it comes back to me again, I am literally in a stupor because of how potent that stuff is now compared to when I was a kid. I had planned, this is a night I can party. I can actually hang out with people and have got great conversations. After about 10 minutes, I had to excuse myself and go away because I can't play that game. I can't be, you know, like me every night. The me, I can be the me that is the introvert, but I can't be that other me. Well, I'm on set. And at the end, I go to the last party, and sometimes I dance on tables. You know, you never know.
That's awesome. So, like, you know, the film deals obviously with a lot of serious issues. We spoke about it, addiction and toxic behavior. And I love that you mentioned that, you know, the lockbox and the hiding of the drugs. That always was one of my favorite parts of the film, was like where they would pop up next. So it's amazing to know where the origin of that piece came from. But I'm curious, what's been the reaction of people that have seen this film or this family on screen and going, I recognize that, you know, behavior or challenges? What have they said to you? And has it become, do you almost feel like you become almost like a, you know, you have to be almost a spokesperson for something like this, for you, this character that's not you, when people kind of meet that?
Yeah, absolutely. We experienced it the most, interestingly enough, in Austin, when we were very first at South By, when the film just came from out of nowhere. And then they kept adding screenings, and it ended up winning the Narrative Award at South By Southwest. And then it won the Audience Award, which for a film this dark is really hard for me to fathom. So they kept adding screenings. So it was a long period of time during which all of us were there for Q&As, which is kind of unusual. You usually, you know, for the first few screenings, everybody's there, and then it's, you know, just it, later it was just Trey and I. Like when we came to London, it was just Trey and I. And here is exactly what we noticed. Em commented on it, all right? So the lights come up. The people who headed for Robin, the sister, were people who had been codependent or enablers or the family of somebody with this issue. The people who headed for Vicky, the sister whose daughter had actually, this had been based on, by the time the stories had come out and they knew who she was, the people who headed to her were the people who had lost someone. Someone had died, you know, that they love. The people who headed for me were the people who wanted to tell me how long their sobriety was, and the people who wanted to tell me how long they were heroin addicts for, and the people who wanted to tell me that they'd never seen it so right in a film. And then, of course, to bring myself up out of the place I go when I think about that, I have to remember that the people who headed for Trey were the ones who were very interested in how he changed the aspect ratio all the time. So every one of us always knew the story of the person heading for us. And the only time it changed is when maybe Robin got a person who comes and said, I was a heroin addict myself, and now my child is a heroin addict. You know, it was very predictable. They wanted hugs, and we gave them to them. And they wanted to know that we were all okay. And we gave them that too. And it speaks to the power of film. Whenever I see a film and I see people going to speak to the filmmakers, and I know that they are going to speak to the person who resonated for them.
That's amazing. I've never thought of that before, that people will come to all in different ways. That's amazing. Is it a heavy burden for you when you get those people kind of bearing their soul to you? I know it's something that you do professionally and you've done in this film. Is that a heavy burden to bear when people are being open about some really tough stuff with you?
It's only a heavy burden while they're telling you. And then I always felt that what I could give back instead of, how to say this, when people have had experiences this, it's very easy to go to a dark view. It's home. It feels like a comfort zone to cry and to think only of the loss and to think only of the burden that you were to other people or the burden that this person was to you, or to only go to that side of it. But for anyone who has gone through that to the other side, all they need is for somebody to hug them and then look in their face and say, and it's better now, right? And then they get the chance to tell you how it's better. And I didn't see that as a burden. I saw it as an opportunity. If there had been no closure to every one of the conversations, if there had been 50 people there and I couldn't connect with each one, but there never were, the people who were seriously moved by the film, many of them were still in their seats. They couldn't get up for a while. Or they were standing against the walls. They couldn't leave, and they couldn't come and talk to us. And sometimes when my line had dwindled, I would walk across to one of those people. I consider myself a force for light, not dark. And I've done that in life, and I feel that Trey is blessed to have both his mother and I. We're very light people. We grew up in a dark family. Trey is a blend of light and dark, and it helps his art. But our job is not to take him to the dark place. He can find that really well by himself. We all can find that really well by ourselves. But we looked at our job as to try to bring a little light at the end into someone's. Every time someone asked me, and this could be a spoiler for somebody who's not seen the film, so I'll be careful. Anytime someone asked me, what happened to your character after the last shot of the movie? I asked them first, what do you think? And no matter what they said, I told them my truth was that I think she made it. I think she made it. I had to believe that because ours didn't, you know? I have to go there. I can't be a person who lives with all addicts die. The man I'm in relationship with right now has been almost 30 years sober. So I can't do that. I can't go there. He's the first one to tell me that if he didn't go to meetings and that he would be, Mom, at risk. He knows he's always at risk. When you're not an addict or an alcoholic and you know or love someone who is, your job is not to be the person who's doubting them. Your job is to be the person who believes in them until there's a boundary crossed. And then sometimes you have to be the person who's tough loving them. And that was exactly what instigated Trey making the film, is that we reached a point with our addict where we had to tough love her and she didn't live through it.
Like, what was your reaction seeing the film for the first time? I mean, it's got truly one of the most unforgettable opening shots of an A24 film, for example. You know, just that, it opens in your face, that ominous music. What was that moment like for you as an actress and as a member of this family watching that film for the first time? And how did you see it for the first time?
To answer that, I'm going to tell you a story that I just heard the other day from Lucas Hedges, who's in Waves. It was a Q&A after the first time that he saw Waves. And when the guy got to him and asked him, how did it feel seeing the film for the first time? And he said, okay, I'm having the weirdest deja vu. When I was back in my seat, I knew that in a little bit I would be up here and you would be asking me what it felt like. And I would have to say to you, I think I just watched the best film I've ever seen. And he said, I brought a notebook with me. I take it always. And in the notebook, I write all the things about my performance I hate. He said, I never opened the book. In this instance, I completely was able to detach from me. And I loved that boy in the film. And that is exactly what I felt the first time I saw Krisha. I was able to completely divorce myself from it and watch it. And I thought it was incredible. A masterpiece. There are not enough words. I couldn't believe that this child that used to, you know, when he was six, he used to do Batman reviews for me. And he knew the directorial style of all the different Batman directors. I couldn't believe this came out of that guy who liked to surf and liked to kayak and liked to wrestle and was a jock. And I saw him with completely new eyes, and those eyes have not changed, of course, since then. But as for me, myself, my own work, I never would have thought that I could do that. It had to do with he knowing me so well that he knew if I was hiding behind anything. And he was able to elicit the most honest performance that I can imagine ever giving, playing a character that was patently different than myself. You never want to, if you have the chance to feel something like that, you always want to feel it.
Well, I'm glad that both you and Lucas were not able to open a book of complaints about those movies. That's just something really awesome. I've never heard of anything like that before, and that's pretty awesome.
Yeah, it's a great feeling, actors, we're like, we stand in front of mirrors and look at our flaws. You know, we don't see what other people see. The very first time I ever saw myself large on screen, it was in a film that was in a Seattle Film Festival, and I'd never been to a film that I'd been in and seen it on a big screen, and all I could do was look at the pores on my nose. I was like, oh my god. Oh my God, look at, I have huge pores on my nose. And later on I went, why was that the place you went? When you're at home in front of a mirror, you do plenty of that. When you're seeing yourself and another character on stage, put the notebook away. don't find the fault. Find the other person and be proud that you did that.
what was it like for you as, you know, you as an actor and as a family to have such a film that had such incredible reviews and reactions from festivals like Cannes and so on, for people like yourself, a professional actor all your life, to people that have never starred in a film, to Trey's debut feature? What was it all like for you to have created something that it just hasn't just resonated, but it's been a critical success and sort of approved by all these kind of critical elites and festivals? What's that been like?
Well, I can only tell you the very first was starting. The buzzword we shared among us was Fellini on acid. The whole experience of it felt like you had walked into a Fellini movie and then you were peaking on acid. It seemed completely unreal. There was always the certainty that you were going to wake up and be like, oh, my God, I can't even believe what I just dreamed. Or for my take was a piano was definitely going to fall on me from out of the sky, from a plane, out of an airplane. A piano is going to come and smash me because I cannot ever achieve anything any better than this in my whole life. This is the highest high of my life. It's very surreal. It absolutely is. And we luckily had the opportunity to really go with it and appreciate it and laugh a lot. And what would you think it would be like? You can't even imagine. You can't believe it. Every new thing, it's like, okay, so for instance, I get a phone call from Trey one day. He's like, Kita, it was right after South By. I'm like, what? He goes, okay, so I just got a call from a guy who's from France, and he said he was at Cannes, and I went, whoa, 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 don't go there. I said, what did he sound like? He said, he sounded like a French guy, and I went, okay, what did he say? And he said he was from Cannes, and that they wanted Krisha to come to Cannes, and I went, no, Trey, somebody is. I said, what was the, did you look at the telephone number? What was the phone number? And he went, it was from France, and I went, holy moly. For the whole first like 3 minutes, the gentleman could not get him to believe that this was real. He thought a friend was pranking him. And so it was pretty much like that all along the way.
That's amazing. And what's it like for yourself? Do you talk about yourself as a teacher, but do you think of yourself as perhaps a role model and inspiration for others, where, you know, we hear it's so difficult to become an actor, to even be in a feature film or to be in something that's successful and resonates with people. And, you know, we know how even difficult, you know, you touched on it earlier, how difficult and thankless an industry it is for female actors, even before you get into older actors, how difficult it is to get meaningful parts as well. And you've shown that, you've persisted, you've got this film, Krisha, that has gone to Cannes, gone and had such success, and your face is front and center. It's on the posters. You're the leading character. Do you find yourself a bit of an inspiration to people that are maybe struggling at their careers or looking for someone to say, hey, this could be me? Do you feel that could be you?
I hope so. I would love to do that. I mean, I know when I was a younger actor and I was making a living on a sidebar form of acting, I did a little teaching, and when the kids would, you know, ask me, well, what do you think my chances are? And I would say, look, here's what I say to everyone. Is there anything in your life that makes you as happy as acting does? Makes you feel as good inside when it's going well? If the answer is that there is no other thing, then become an actor. If there's some other thing, do that. I mean, I seriously was that jaded and a little bit kind of like, wow, I couldn't believe that I was never going to get a chance to do these things. But I also was very willing to do. I wanted to sleep with people. I wasn't willing to lose 30 pounds. I wasn't, you know, you hear this now that women are being told, you know, don't let your sexuality be known. Don't, you know, lose X amount of weight before you do this. And that was the world I lived in. I was supposed to, I had a makeup artist tell me when I was in my early 30s that I needed to have plastic surgery on my eyes pronto. And I went, what do you mean? And she said, well, you have bags under your eyes. They can take care of that. And I went, those are my bags under my eyes. So I was boundaried around what I was willing to give up of me to get that. And I was also, to be honest, very conflicted about whether I wanted that, because I knew I wanted to act. I didn't want all the rest of it so much. I'm kind of a private person. Da, da, da. So for me, I consider myself to be the biggest inspiration because I lived a happy, productive life without grieving that I never got to do the thing I wanted to do. And then in the end, like some big joke of a gift from somewhere, then I get to do the other thing. And I'm of an age that nobody is telling me that I need to have a certain kind of body or a certain kind of face. So to me, it's very gratifying. And I think that everybody, as they get older, needs a little bit of encouragement about the fact that you're the best you've ever been. And it doesn't matter if your body is not the best body or your face is not the best body. Inside, you are the strongest, best person you've ever been. So don't let people tell you otherwise. And in that sense, I would love to be a role model for that, because life is too hard when you don't get to do the things you want to do, but life is long enough that you might get to do it later.
Yeah, right on. Like, I mean, at time of like recording, by the time this drops, I'll have thankfully seen it. It was announced today that Waves will be coming to the London Film Festival, so I'll finally get the chance to see it there. I mean, it seems to be getting incredible reviews at the moment, and I'm trying to go in as blind as possible to this one. I know I'm going to enjoy it. But I've noticed that you've got a role in this film. Can you tease a little bit about your role and what we can maybe look forward to with Waves?
Well, my role is very easy to tease because it's one line. Here's what happened. I was on my way up to Northern California to shoot this film that, you know, that I have coming out, and it's a big, heavy role with a lot of, like, I'm pulling a lot of weight, Trey reaches out to me, and he's shooting Waves in Florida, and he says, "Can you fly down to shoot for one day?" And I'm like, I'm already in San Francisco. I have 3 days off before I have to go to the set. He said, "I can send a car for you early tomorrow morning. And if you get on a plane, then you could do costume and wardrobe tomorrow. And then you can shoot and then you can travel back the next day. Could you?" And I had read the script. And I have to say, reading the script, just as a sidebar, I had never read anything like it. I had never experienced anything like it. It just blew me away. And I thought I knew what he wanted me to do. And I said, "The English teacher?" And he said, "Yes." Because this was a teacher who'd been kind of inspirational to him when he was young. And at the time, it had two lines. After he had to cut the movie from 2 hours and 15 minutes, I had one line. But it was the perfect line. And the perfect little flash of me walking across a scene. I was a lucky charm. He wanted me to come and do it and be a part of it, but I didn't belong in that film. I was getting ready to go make a film that I own. So it's like he asked me to do that. I did it. We had a wonderful time. I got to meet all the kids. It was just the perfect, for me, little piece. I think the best thing I could tell you about the Waves experience is that Robin and I, his mother and I, we're such yentas. We both went to Telluride, and then we both went to Toronto, because it's like she was having a grandbaby, and we wanted to be there for the birth, right? And the first time we saw it, it's audacious is such a good word. People use that word about it. And we were nervous about it. We knew he was going to do it, but we were nervous. It was quite an endeavor. So the first time we saw it, we were both so nervous. I found that I was with the audience breathing together, and we were all crying at the same place, and we were all gasping at the same place. And it was, again, a surreal experience. And I was just, I couldn't even speak after it was over. Okay, the second time I went to see it, it was in a theater with 360 sound. That was the most visceral experience I can remember ever in a film. I felt that the audience was like an organism. And we were all breathing together. And experiencing this together, it's like voyeurism. There really is a sense that you are watching these lives. Kind of, there was some of that in Krisha. There was some of that in It Comes at Night. He is a genius at so many things, but one of the things that you can't ever miss, casting. The people that he chose to be these people, having read the script when I first saw them as the person, they were the exact right person for that role, exactly right. And they formed a family just like we did. And when you see them standing up at Q&As and they're hanging all over each other and they're teasing each other and they're he made them into a family. And I won't say anything more about it except that it's a real ride, and for me, it's an important film.
I can't wait to see it. You've got me excited. I've avoided the trailer. I've avoided the reviews. I've just seen the good buzz. So a couple more weeks, and I'll finally get the chance to see it. So it was such a hype when it was like when they announced the original film festival lineup, and I was like, oh, why isn't Waves in there? And then today they went, here it is, just a few weeks later. So I knew
it was going to be, but we weren't allowed to tell anyone. So it was like, just don't say anything, don't indicate anything. Now, I do want to say this, and you can put this in or leave this out, whatever you like. What I'm finding in reading the reviews, there are two very strong pools of experience in this film. One dark and one light. And a lot of people get one and are kind of about the other. For people who, I feel, for people who have really lived and really allowed themselves to feel things deeply and allowed themselves to go places emotionally, I think when you read a review where they got both, that's the perspective of a person who has both of those in their experience, and they can see it when they know it when they see it. I think some people, they've not gone near one part of that life experience or the other, and so they resonate really strongly to one half of the film and a little less to the other. Nothing wrong with that. It's working when it works like that. But just keep your eyes open and see if you run into that situation with people that you know who see it.
Excellent. Yeah, I certainly will. And I'm curious, well, what's it like to be in, you know, obviously there's Waves, but most importantly, Krisha, what's it like to be in an A24 film and be part of their filmography and, you know, it's be part of it?
Well, you know, when you see those pictures of the heyday of Hollywood and the actors are all sitting on the soundstage and they're all sitting in their chairs smiling and they've all been through hair and makeup and they're just like happy that they have a contract with MGM or whoever the studio was. A24's class picture would be the exact opposite of that. And every single person in it would not believe their luck that they're a part of that. When we were driving to South by Southwest to show Krisha, and Trey's in the backseat and Robin's driving, and I said to him, okay, Trey, let's just do a hypothetical, let's do a time jump. Let's imagine that the movie's already screened and that people like it. And what would you want? What would be the very best optimal outcome you could imagine? And he didn't take a beat of more than about a split second. A24 would buy it. And I went, who? And he went, A24. And Robin went, who is that? And he's like, it's a small company. They were only, you know, they only started in 2012. And I went, oh, no, Trey, you know, you should set your sights higher. You know, there's big studios that could be interested in you. And he went, no, you just need to trust me on this. If A24 bought it, it would be the very best thing that could ever happen. And he was right. And we didn't know that because we didn't even know who they were. So they treat everyone who is involved with them in any way like family. They are the nicest people to work for. And I mean, I was in Hollywood for a while. I know that it can go the other way. They are so not there's so not anything phony baloney about them. They're just very, very real, very. And I mean, okay, here's another little one that you'll like. Eighth grade, Bo Burnham.
Yeah, I love them. We've had Bo Burnham on the show as well, and he's a real great guy.
What a great guy he is. Okay, so A24 had an Oscar party, and they invited it to me, and me to it. And I was going to be in LA, and I'm like, oh my God, I'll go to an Oscar party. That'll be fun. So I'm sitting in this party, and there's this very tall man, and he's like staring at me from across the room. And I'm like, okay, whatever, you know. And he keeps staring at me. And I finally just, he was standing next to someone I knew. And I got up and I went over and I spoke to the guy. And the guy said, how are you doing? And I said, oh, you know, at parties like this, I'm like completely, I said, I've been invisible since I was 50. And then there was the whole Crecia thing. And then I was visible for a while. And now I'm like invisible again. And this tall creature bends way over, very close to my face, and he says, you are absolutely not invisible to me. I can't take my eyes off of you. And I went, thank you? And I said, who are you? And he said, oh, I'm nobody. My name is Bo, and I'm going to be doing a film for A24. And I went, you are? That's so cool. What's it called? It's just a little film about young kids and everything. It's like, it's nothing compared to Crecia. But I just needed to tell you. And he started to like fan on me, and I'm like, no, tell me about your film. And there was like this little moment, and then he just started, you know, telling me about the film. And I went, that sounds really interesting. And he's like, well, I hope so. You know, A24 thinks it's going to be good, but I hope so. And then somebody calls to me from across the room, and I'm like, okay, good luck, Bo. And I reach up and give him a hug, and I go over and I sit down next to my friends, and they're like, what were you doing talking to Bo Burnham? And I'm like, who? They're like, Bo Burnham. And I'm like, I have no idea who he was. The tall guy. I'm so out of it. You know, I'm almost 70 years old. How do I know who Bo Burnham is? Right? And they tell me, he has like millions of followers on social media. And I went, what does he do? And they said, he's really funny. And I went, he did not say a single funny thing to me. We talked very, very seriously. He's funny? And then, so that's my Bo Burnham in filmmaker mode story. And he, again, also found A24 to just be this incredibly nurturing place. It's like a place where you can bring the craziest thing in the world to them, and they'll listen and they'll go, huh, I want to hear more about this, instead of you're out of your mind. And that's what creative people need, and that's what they're giving them. And Trey is he's been blessed, he says, you know, and it's true, to have done all three of his films with them.
My smile listening to that Bo Burnham story could stretch from Scotland to Mexico, where you are just now. That is just a brilliant story. I would love to have been a fly on the wall watching that one. That was just magic.
It really, I mean, later on, of course, what was the first thing I did when I got home? I looked him up and I was like, holy, he's really famous. And I had a moment of like, oh, I wonder if he was hurt that I didn't recognize him. And then I went, no, he was humility itself. He was self-denigrating. He was to the point of like, I wanted to say, go Bo. What a great thing that a guy like him with all that in him finds A24. What a great thing that a guy like Trey, Robert Eggers. I mean, these guys that just are like, they're drawn to the freedom that they feel. And then what they also find is a support system unlike any other.
Did you have you seen Eighth Grade in the end?
No, I have not. I have to. In Mexico, it's very hard for me to get stuff, so I have to sadly to wait till things are streaming to be able to see. And I definitely want to see it. I read the reviews. I was like over the moon reading the reviews. I was like, yes, my buddy Bo. Everybody's like, you know Bo Burnham? I'm like, well, not really. But he's my buddy.
I think A24 need to send you a care package, not just with that mug, but they need to send you an 8th grade Blu-ray in there as well.
Oh, I would love it. I would love it.
Is there any of their other films as well that have kind of stood out for you? Because I think I've touched on this before with some other guests where, you know, A24 are great at putting women and stories about women of all ages front and center in their filmography as well. what films have stood out for you, and how important is the sort of diversity of their filmography to viewers like yourself and actors and talent?
Well, I mean, it's pretty clear, isn't it? I mean, who makes Barry Jenkins' second film? You know, they do. Greta Gerwig. I mean, they have an eye for what someone is capable of, and then it doesn't matter to them what color they are, or what gender they are, or what age even that they are. They're gonna help them do what they're capable of. To my mind, that diversity, and the diversity of the genres, let's even just look at that. I mean, where in the world, who is going to make Lighthouse? Who is going to make The Lighthouse, a black and white film with two unbelievable performances, one of them by a guy that I used to think of as like eye candy, right? When Pattison first came out, I was like, oh, he's just some gorgeous, hunky, young guy who'll be gone in like 3 years. You know, no. Not true. A Defoe, you can never miss a Defoe. You know, the first time you see him, you're always going to see everything he's in. You know, The Lighthouse doesn't get made, and it doesn't get seen by that many people when there isn't an A24. I was bowled over by Uncut Gems, which you probably haven't had a chance to see yet either.
No, there's not even a trailer for it yet in the UK. It's not even coming to London yet. Lighthouse is on the agenda, but Uncut Gems is, I'm desperate to see it.
Well, I saw it on a morning at 9:30 in the morning, or no, 10:30. It was a little better than I thought. And I thought, oh, this is not going to be my cup of tea. I love the Safdie brothers, but the tension and the stress, but I also love a good caper film. Just a wild ride. Very interestingly, Waves and Uncut Gems have the thing that they have in common, the only thing, besides both being brilliant, is that they're both rides. You better, as when the Safdie brothers were introducing it, they said, thank you for coming here in the morning, but we consider this film to be like a big cup of coffee. And Adam Sandler, I mean, I've seen his what I thought was his best work before and thought he was good, thought he was, you know, a genius in the stuff that he did. Never expected anything like this from him. There's something that A24 does with the permission that they give people to go out on ledges with their performances and with their directing and with their art directing and with their cinematography and it just I don't want to jinx it because you know if they turn it into some old-fashioned kind of studio that only cares about the buck someday. But I'm hoping that centuries from now.
Absolutely. Like, you've touched on this movie that you've got coming up about the dope and so on. What other kind of projects can we look out for or perhaps listen out for that you might be involved in the future?
You know, it's interesting. I guess the best way to say this is I don't work the system well. Like, I don't have an agent. I couldn't find an agent to take me. Isn't that interesting after Krisha? I couldn't find an agent to take me because, now think about this and this does make sense. They all had older actresses already in their stable that they had long-term loyalty to and long-term relationships with, and they were like, we don't need another one, we've got someone that's your same age. And of course the answer to that, had I been able to, you know, give it, is no two people are ever alike, no two artists are ever alike. We can play similar things, but I mean, my feeling was, take me as your backup. If that person's booked, you can say, oh, well, would you like to get Krisha to read it? You know, it shocked me, to be honest, that I couldn't get an agent. I have a manager through a friend. Everything that comes to me through people who already know my work. And I did a series on the Sci-Fi Channel, a show called Channel Zero. I'm very proud of. I played a kick-ass older woman. I got to chase Rutger Hauer around in tunnels, shooting at him. And I was, you know, I I have a chainsaw scene where I'm the one wielding it. I mean, it was a horror series like no other, and it was a wonderful experience. And they saw Krisha, and they trusted me to be this kick-ass older woman in this film, the film that I'm doing where I play the pot grower. They saw Krisha, and they trusted me to be someone else. But I'm not having any luck other than with people who already know of me. And I believe that with the years that I have left, there'll be enough of those, and I'll have enough cool projects to keep me busy as long as I want to. And then if it gets to the point where it's more work and I wanted to stay here in my hammock with my dogs, then I won't care anymore. But it was an interesting, leveler. It's a real kind of an ego leveler, you know, when you think, oh, well, I was in all these festivals, my name is on the, in this business, it's about relationships. And I have not been able to establish new relationships with people who I haven't met yet or haven't seen my work. But when people have seen it, then I have relationships with them. So I have no idea what beyond this film, but I have no doubt it'll be something, because I bring about 180%, and I have a lot of people inside me that still haven't gotten a chance to speak.
Absolutely. You know, you're talking about creating not relationships there. I think I'm speaking perhaps as an audience member. You create a relationship with me when I watch that film. And I think it goes for a lot of people that have found your film, or whether they're making their way through an A24 filmography or catching it as an iTunes rental or something like that. You know, you're certainly creating a relationship with the audience. And even coming on a podcast like this, you know, you're doing this for, you know, for whatever reason you wanted to come on, you're coming on and talking with people and listeners. And it's really great to be able to listen to these stories, insights and experiences. And, you know, I think you said at the beginning, you know, that teacher role, I really get that vibe from you as well. And I can understand that connection. So I can only be really thankful for you coming on to the show today.
Well, I had such a good time. We can only live through what we live through, but we learn a lot when other people tell us what they've lived through. And my life was full of mentors, good and bad. And some actors may hear this and think, oh, well, that's bad advice. You know, don't play the system. You got to get in there. You got to get the agent. You got to da, da, da. And other actors will go like, wow, a like-minded view. You just, in this business, you got to listen to everybody whose work you respect or admire, because there's something there that you can take from it. And so if I gave anybody anything, I'm just glad to have done it.
And finally, if people wanted to keep up to date with any news or insights or dog pictures, for example, where's sort of the best social media perhaps to catch you, Krisha?
I use Facebook personally for my personal life. I use Twitter, and it's pretty simple. It's just Krisha Fairchild. I'm on like a site called Demo Reel where they can see, you know, whenever I've done new work, I put up stuff. I'm a Twitter gal. I like the level of engagement intellectually on Twitter. I'm not an Instagram person. To me, it's like anonymous sex in a washroom. And Twitter feels like, to me, more like a book group, you know, or like a group of people who love films, and we read each other's kind of takes on them. And you just can feel free to kind of jump in with ideas. I love the sharing there. So yeah, that's the best place to find me. And like I say, if the film does as well as they're expecting it to, we might get lucky and get a theatrical. It's an art house film, you know, but I don't know. I just saw my first two completed scenes and like kind of am in love with some of it. It's a very sweet story. It made me cry. So when you can see something that you've done and separate from it, and a scene can move you, that's a good indicator.
Well, I can't wait to see that and Waves and everything else you do in the future. And maybe I'll have thanks to dive into some of your other filmography as well. But thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure to talk with you today. And I honestly, it's been one of my favorite interviews to carry out. So thank you so much.
Oh, Oh, thank you. I had a ball. And you may notice I didn't end up talking with a Scottish accent by the end of it. So I guess I used restraint because it's a bad habit I have.
Oh, hey, no, it doesn't stop other people. But honestly, thank you so much.